Hey everybody, how's it going? Thanks for joining me this afternoon. I've got a great stream with a great guest that I think you're really going to enjoy. So a lot of us have seen these dystopian movies. There's a trend of them coming out. They predict the downfall of civilization, some horrific future. But one of the ones that I think gets passed over because it was a little bit quirkier, is kind of more of a comedy, a little more British, is Terry Gilliam's Brazil. And I think it's an amazing movie because it doesn't just give us a dystopian future. It specifically looks at the bureaucratic aspect of what would happen. It predicts much of the kind of bureaucratic malaise and the terrible, quiet desperation that many people feel when they're trapped in the kind of world that we have today. And so coming on to discuss that great film with me is Stephen Carson. He's the host of the Radical Liberation podcast. Stephen, thanks for coming on, man.
Thank you. Yeah, you know, I just thought of this phrase, Aaron. It's Brazil is the deep state dystopia, right? It's the dystopia that we can connect to from our own experience.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of those that I think in some ways, I wouldn't say understated because the movie obviously is very flamboyant at moments.
Yeah.
Like I said, it really captures that the way that you are stuck inside of this machine. You feel hopeless, feel like there's very little escape. And Terry Gilliam is a director who's very visually gifted. The story of this film is not particularly complicated, but the events, the way they're depicted, are very, very much capture the essence of that experience. I know you're a big fan of the director, so I want to go ahead and dive into his general style and then the specifics of what makes this movie so great. But before we do that, guys, let me tell you a little bit about ISI. Universities today aren't just neglecting real education, they're actively undermining it, and we can't let them get away with it. America was made for an educated and engaged citizenry. The Intercollegiate Studies Institute is here to help. ISI offers programs and opportunities for conservative students across the country. ISI understands that conservatives and right-of-center students feel isolated on college campuses and that you're often fighting for your own reputation, dignity, and future. Through ISI, you can learn about what Russell Kirk called the permanent things, the philosophical and political teachings that shaped and made Western civilization great. ISI offers many opportunities to jumpstart your career. They have fellowships at some of the nation's top conservative publications like National Review, The American Conservative, and The College Thinker. If you're a graduate student, ISI offers funding opportunities to sponsor the next great generation of college professors. Through ISI, you can work with conservative thinkers who are making a difference, thinkers like Chris Rufo, who currently has an ISI researcher helping him with his book. But perhaps most importantly, ISI offers college students a community of people that can help them grow. If you're a college student, ISI can help you start a student organization or a student newspaper or meet other like-minded students at their various conferences and events. ISI is here to educate the next generation of great Americans. To learn more, go to ISI.org. That's ISI.org. All right, so before we dive into Brazil itself, let's talk a little bit about its director, because I think Terry Gilliam is a guy who has a very specific style. Like I said, it's incredibly unique. That's one of the things that lends this movie part of its genius, because it communicates so much of the dystopia in a visual manner. And it's interesting because most people probably just know him as the other guy from Monty Python, right? It's not John Cleese from Monty Python. He's one of these guys. He had a couple of movies early on that were aimed at more of a mainstream audience, I think, with things like Time Bandits. I've seen a few of his movies. Probably 12 Monkeys is the other big commercially successful one most people would be familiar with. Yeah. But he feels like the kind of guy that, he kind of goes into hiding for 5 years and then emerges to make a weird movie and then goes back underground and, you know, if he sees his shadow. And so can you talk a little bit about Gilliam and his kind of movie and directing style?
Yeah, so Gilliam was part of the Monty Python crew and those guys, and he was involved with some of their films, right? Like Monty Python, The Holy Grail, Life of Brian, Meaning of Life. He directed at least two of them, I think. And Time Bandits, I view as sort of transitional. I love it. I recommend it. I've shown it to my kids. It's kind of transitional. It feels a bit more like a Monty Python film. It's got kind of like sketches, little sort of pieces you could watch by themselves, right? Sort of a series of sketches where they're bouncing around in history. But you start to see Gilliam finding his own way. It's not quite a Monty Python film. It's not quite a Gilliam film. With Brazil, which is his next film after, after Time Bandits, this is now Gilliam finding his voice. And after this, his films, I think, are just brilliant. The greatness begins with Brazil, and it just keeps going through his other films. So Gilliam is one of my two favorite directors, along with David Lynch, the American director David Lynch. And one of the things I find in common between them is an emphasis on dreams. If you've ever seen Twin Peaks, which if you haven't, do it. If you haven't seen the Twin Peaks series, there's a big emphasis on dreams. He's using dreams. Special Agent Cooper is using dreams to actually help solve the mystery, right? So dreams are actually a part of the plot. Well, in Brazil, dreams are about as far forward as they are in any of Gilliam or Lynch's work. The dreams are a major part of how we know what is inside the heart of the main character, right? Because when he's in the real world, when he's not dreaming, he's kind of a drone stuck in a bureaucratic world. He seems a bit hapless, you know, kind of pushed around. He's starting to maybe find that he has things he cares about, wants to fight for. But in his dreams, he's a hero, right? He is the center of the dream, and these are not nightmares. These are heroic dreams, fantasy. His dreams are like fantasy, you know, like the genre, like think Tolkien or something, right? Filled with flying and fighting and up in the sky. He's broken out. He's out of the box in his dreams. Right?
Yeah, he looks like Ziggy Stardust with giant angel wings flying around, right? Like it's radically juxtaposed to his existence as like you said, this cog in the machine of this giant bureaucratic state. And that definitely shows, I think it very much captures that quiet desperation that a lot of people feel when they're stuck in corporate jobs. I mean, The Matrix does this in a way. Obviously, it's famous for breaking you out of the Matrix, and you know, Neo's in this, you know, very boring office job doing this coding or whatever. But Brazil does it in a far more fantastic way. It feels almost like a Dio album, or you know, some kind of power metal album art as he's flying around trying to free the princess from these from these evil people and everything. It definitely evokes a much different spirit. It's not all this slick 90s stuff. It definitely has that 80s fantasy, Willow or something like that feel to it, involved in there. So let's go ahead and start at the beginning, you know, to kind of set the stage for people. The film begins with one of these dream sequences. So we kind of know what's going on in his head. But then we also see this extremely oppressive and very British bureaucratic world. The world that we are introduced to is one that is, there's lots of, the first thing I notice is lots of ductwork. Ductwork is everywhere in this film. Like the hilarious thing about the ductwork is it's this industrial grade, it's very ugly, and it's strewn through everything. So even when you're in fancy restaurants, like we get a scene where he's supposed to be eating in this fancy restaurant with his mother and everything, there's still this duct work just coming out of the bottom of what are supposed to be these fancy tables and strewn throughout everywhere. So it's just very ugly and oppressive. And when when we look at the technology, there's lots of technology everywhere, but in a way it's like the technology, like someone from the 1950s would imagine what technology would look like in the future, right? It's got that there's computers, but they all look like typewriters, and they have these giant magnifying glasses. So things are technologically advanced, but they're in a very particular, ugly, industrial way.
Right. Yeah. It's making me think of the cartoonist Crom, who, when he draws a street, he really brings forward all the telephone wires and the, you know, cables running around and stuff like that. It's like that, right? When you're in the world of Brazil, the infrastructure is almost cartoonishly exaggerated, right? With the ductwork everywhere, it's so that you can't ignore that you're sort of shrinking down in the midst of all this infrastructure that sort of oppresses you. And an important plot point, you can't touch it. You can't touch the ductwork, or, you know, you got to get the right licensed people and fill out the right forms, or you are toast. You know, they will crush you.
Yeah, we see early on that the kind of how the bureaucracy is brutal towards people and cares very little about them, while, like you said, just burying them under this stuff. So the things that sets the events in motion, and guys, spoiler alert for a movie that is literally as old as I am. It's a very old movie. So if you haven't seen it by now, fix that. But we're going to be talking about the plot here. We have to. So what sets the events in motion is that, you know, the torture orders that come up for dissidents inside the bureaucracy are typed out in these old style typewriters that automatically print out. And one of the guys is trying to smash a bug, right? There's like this comedic scene, because the whole thing is a satire while also being extremely dark at the same time. And so there's this kind of this comedic scene where the guy is trying to, you know, stack all this really cheap bureaucratic furniture on top of each other so he can kill the one fly in his tiny office that's bothering him. And the fly drops onto the typewriter and messes up the type, and it misses it by one letter. And so after, you know, this absurd scene of this guy trying to go ahead and you know, kind of get this fly, we get a hit squad that is coming after the guy who just got the wrong order. And so just this average British man with his family sitting there watching Christmas.
Random guy.
Yeah. And they like cut a hole and they slide in, and this whole SWAT team shows up and, you know, threatening the murder and murder him, and they bag him up.
Oh, they put a hood over his head and take him away.
Yeah. And then the best part is, you know, at the end of this whole thing, his, you know, traumatized wife has to like sign a form in triplicate. You know, the bureaucrat comes in and it's like, no, you have to press down harder. Make sure that we get the signature traced in so that you have a receipt for the murder of your husband.
Right. Yeah, because they have to pay for their own execution or something. It comes out of their account, which is the next plot point. Yeah.
Yeah, and so that's kind of the world we're set in. We actually, I should say, the movie actually starts with a little vignette of an absurd kind of Christmas commercial, and as people are pushing the cart by during the absurd kind of very British Christmas commercial, trying to sell some insane product on a wall full of TVs for Christmas, the whole thing explodes. Right. Like there's an explosion. So we know this is a world that is very regimented, very depressed and oppressively bureaucratic. But we also know there's like terrorism happening in the background. Right. From that visualization.
Yeah. And I wonder on how much that resonates now. I remember revisiting Brazil around the 9/11 era. And feeling like, wow, Gilliam was a prophet. Yes, terrorism. And, we're all being oppressed in the name of terror, you know, terrorism and stuff. And how much is the government, like, kind of behind it in a way, you know? All these thoughts were brought up by Brazil, where, to make it comically absurd, things blow up and everybody just goes about their business almost as if nothing happened. They just kind of sweep a little bit and move on, you know? Like this is, the implication being that these terror incidents are just happening all the time and just people go about their lives, you know?
Yeah, again, that's another absurdist thing that gets introduced in the fancy restaurant scene where they're all sitting there trying to eat their fancy food, which isn't, it's gross. They have to pick from a cheap McDonald's style menu. You have to say the number. You can't tell me you want a steak. You have to pick the fast food number, even though we're in a fasty restaurant. And then they just get a slop of goop that has the picture of the actual dish on top of it. But during this whole thing, you know, that scene, the everything explodes and there's lots of terrorism. And everyone is, you know, the waiters are kind of embarrassed. Like all the people eating there are like, oh, you can't get rid of the terrorists, as if there's like a homeless man sitting in front of, you know, the whole thing. And you wonder how much of that is like a reflection of the British experience of kind of the World War II bombings. right? Mm-hmm. The keep on and carry on thing where we're supposed to just keep consuming and act like everything's normal, even though things are exploding around us.
Yeah, and it's sort of a bomb, what do they call it? Bomb shelter humor or whatever, right?
Right.
Sort of a carrying that tradition forward.
Yeah. So we have our main character, and he gets introduced to this whole thing because he works in like the information department. He's got to file a check somewhere, right? Like the check has to be written to the family of the guy who ended up dying in his interrogation for being a terrorist, even though he wasn't a terrorist, right? And we find out that
the issue is that the main character realizes that there's been a mistake.
Right.
And that, you know, like it's not lining up. The name of the person who got snatched and the name of the person who he's supposed to be charging for it or crediting back, they're not the same name. They're off by one letter, as you explained. Right.
Yeah. And that's the whole terrifying thing for them, is that the bureaucracy is supposed to be perfect. Like one of the propaganda posters, because we get a lot of these 1984 style propaganda posters throughout the film. And one of them is that information makes you free. That is one of their big things, is we have all the information. We have all the experts. We know all the answers, right? And so this is a very scientific, you know, people today will recognize all of these claims, right? We have a very scientifically perfect system that has been measured out. The experts are in charge. And because we have all the data and we have all the science and, you know, the science is always correct, then any idea that the bureaucracy would make a mistake is ridiculous. It's de facto, ridiculous. And so the fact
we have studies. So exactly, don't worry about it, man.
Right. Just trust the science. It's fine. And so, so the fact that his boss, you know, he finds this mistake and his boss just melts down. That, you know, that how would we ever fix this, right? Like this is the end. We're all done. We're all fired.
His immediate instinct, his boss is shh, hush, right. Quiet. You know, like don't let anyone know that there's been a mistake, right? We've got to cover it up.
Yeah. Right. And so he, as this guy who wants to escape, this kind of oppressive bureaucracy at any moment, he goes ahead and volunteers to drive, right? I'll go out, even though this is something they never do. I'll go drive and deliver this check. And when he does,
hand deliver. And I didn't think about this, Aaron, but this is, he's not thinking about it this way yet, right? But this is a moment of him kind of breaking free of the machine a little bit, right? He's deviating from processes and what's been designed. And he's, instead of doing a bureaucratic process, he is going and going to make human contact. He's going to actually interact with these people personally, not through a process, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Though the woman doesn't have the bank account she's supposed to have. And so they can't just do the impersonal transaction to the widow. Normally they would just, you know, right. and it's some absurd amount. It's like $30. That's the great thing. like your husband is murdered. We owe you $30, right? It's some absurd amount, and normally they would just mail this $30 check. It's funny because one of the reasons I wanted to watch this movie was someone I knew was having an issue like this with the IRS, where their grandmother had died, and they were like in this long 6 month battle trying not to get to figure out what to do with $100 check. The IRS simply would not stop calling. They're like, whatever, I don't care about the $100. Like,
let it go. Yeah, yeah.
So it's like, oh, yeah. So, yeah, this is literally the world we live in. It's very, very much
right.
The
case. Yep.
And I love when he's driving. Again, so much of this is communicated in the visual with Gillum. Yeah. But when he's driving, the billboards on the roads are on both sides. It's just a wall. There is no, you can't see any of the landscape.
All you see is billboards. Yeah, yeah.
Right. Yeah, so there's never this moment where you go from your high rise apartment building where you can't see anything but the city, and then you go to the office where you can't see anything but these ugly duct work everywhere, and then even when you drive to some other part of the world, you are always stuck inside this tunnel of advertisements.
Right. Yeah, and in his dreams, he is in the sky and the clouds, among trees. Right. He's out of this inhuman, industrial, bureaucratic, soulless environment.
Absolutely. So when he finally arrives there, he discovers that the woman from his dreams that he's been dreaming about actually lives upstairs, right? She's been complaining the whole time. We start to see her, trying to figure out what's going on with this poor man who's been drug away. And so he discovers that she's upstairs, but he can't get to her. And eventually she starts showing up to the records department he's at because she wants to file. Yeah. Oh, there's been a false arrest, this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so that's how he figures
she's trying to help this family who lost the husband, the father of the family. And she's trying to intervene as a neighbor.
Yeah. Right. And she goes again through this very DMV like process where she goes to one department, like, sorry, you haven't stamped the form of the arrest receipt. We can't pull any of the information. You have to go to the other one. I've already been to that department. I can't, they're not allowed to talk about that until you've seen. And so she's running around this, this whole kind of gerbil, terrarium thing. Trying to figure out how to get into a department, and he's like trapped up against the glass, constantly chasing her, getting stuck in elevators that go out and people put signs that it can't be fixed for the next 2 weeks because they haven't filed the paperwork as they're like going around this whole time.
And she's not submissive to this whole system, right? I mean, she's trying to work with it out of necessity, but she clearly is not trusting the process. She screams at people. She's emotional. She isn't just like, okay, I'll go get in that line now. She's angry. She's alive, right?
Yeah, and that's absolutely one of the things that draws him to her, because in the other scenes, for instance, again with that fancy restaurant scene, his mother, who is well-to-do, he's a low-level bureaucrat, but he obviously should have been more. That's one of the themes of the film, is he was supposed to want to climb up in the bureaucracy, but he's just interested in having his daydreams, right? He doesn't like this world. He doesn't want to advance in it. He doesn't want to play the game.
In particular, he has turned down a promotion because he didn't want the additional responsibility or whatever. Yeah,
exactly. And that becomes very important later on in the storyline. And so when he shows up, the mother is disappointed. She wants to get him to take this promotion. He gets angry and he's refusing it, but they're trying to set him up with the daughter of one of his mother's friends. And she is this sheepish, she's involved in the whole thing. Yeah. And so this woman who's fiery and fighting back and has that life, has the animation, is coming from outside the system. She definitely is well contrasted with this other woman who is kind of playing the game, she's got like a bunch of facial, she's got these giant braces that, like headgear, like she's still stuck in middle school somewhere from the 70s, that kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's a film, right? So she's not only unattractive in the sense of not having that liveliness of this woman he's drawn to, but she also just doesn't look that great. Right.
Right. So another big theme that is a part of this is the plastic surgery, right? One of the themes we see is, when we're introduced to his mother, she's getting this in fact, if you've only seen maybe two pictures from the movie, you've probably seen this one where they're stretching the mother's face out like silly putty and the doctor is trying to decide where to cut on him. And very interestingly, just like Gillum predicts a lot of the bureaucratic problems, he predicts a lot of the family problems, because the mother, that we never see the father, we know that he died at some point. They have a conversation about how he knew one of the upper ups at something, but he's without a father. The son is without a father, and the mother is treating him as something of just a trophy or something to only pay attention to, very fleetingly, only when she can introduce him or try to, elevate him, make him play the game.
He is like a fashion accessory. If you've ever watched Absolutely Fabulous, you know exactly what the dynamic I'm describing. Yeah.
Right. And she's constantly looking for the attention of younger men right in front of him. And so one of the reasons she's going through these plastic surgeries is to look more presentable to, so that it very much is that, like, single mother who doesn't care very much about the child and is always just, you know, chasing after the attention of younger and younger men. And that's the theme throughout. She keeps getting plastic surgeries. You know, all of the social events are based around the reveal of her latest plastic surgery. And each time she gets younger, she pays less and less attention to him. At the end, basically telling him, just go away. You know, I'm busy talking to all these younger men. You don't matter to me anymore.
Right. Yeah. I mean, she's sort of the, you know, we'll talk about sort of the boomer stereotype, right? It's all about me. It's all about what I'm thinking about right now. I just want to be happy, to use a phrase from a boomer. Just let me be happy, you know, and don't distract me with your stuff, you know?
Right. Absolutely. So the next big kind of twist is when he needs to find the information to track down this girl from his dreams. And I want to get into that because the information retrieval is a very interesting euphemism that ends up getting used in the film. I want to talk a little bit about that. But before we do, guys, let me remind you about your absolute moral duty to get out of the whole bureaucratic thing and hire based people in based companies through New Founding. Hey guys, I need to tell you about today's sponsor, New Founding Talent. Look, we all know that the job market is a disaster right now. Based people can't find good companies to work for, and good companies can't find anybody to get the job done. The competency crisis is very, very real. So how do we get these two incredibly important groups together? We need organizations like New Founding. New Founding has created a network of high excellence professionals who are seeking to join grounded American businesses. These are individuals often in elite organizations who are ready for a team and a mission that supports their values instead of working against them. Aligned companies are already using this network to hire high-trust, exceptional individuals who can match the culture and mission of their teams. So if you're looking for better employees to build a better world, you need to go ahead and apply for access to the New Founding Talent Network at newfounding.com/talent. You'll get connected with candidates who will build your business. That's newfounding.com/talent. Check it out today. All right. So before he gets transferred to information retrieval, he ends up deciding to take this promotion that he's been denying for a long time so he can.
No. He's doing the promotion so he can be in information retrieval.
Right. So he can get access to the information.
Yeah. So he can get to the information about this lady. Yeah.
Right. But before that happens, he runs into an interesting character. So Robert De Niro is in this film out of nowhere. Right. And that's one of the beautiful things about this film. Like, you get Robert De Niro and Bob Hoskins and all these guys who you wouldn't expect to be sprinkled in here as kind of key players. But even though they're kind of
and they practically get like cameos. Right. I mean, they're not even they're not major characters. They're minor characters in the film.
Yes. Yeah. And so what you discover is that Robert De Niro is he's an HVAC technician. He's an air conditioner repairman. And so
he deals with the ducts
that are so often in there. Like you said, you're not allowed to touch him. You're not allowed to fix anything. No, the system always works. There's nothing ever wrong. You know, the central services is this kind of, you know, this bureaucratic organization that takes care of all the maintenance. And our main character calls in because his air conditioning gets stuck, but they won't show up. And so, you know, he keeps getting a recording that says it's not a recording, telling him that, you know, the thing will be taken care of soon. And instead, Robert De Niro's character shows up. And he's the great thing about Robert De Niro's character is that he's this dangerous rogue. You know, he's got to run in with a gun and he's got to scare the main character. And the reason he has the gun is because fixing the ducts is illegal. And he's like he's a scab. He's a non-union, non-government.
He's a freelancer. Yeah.
Fixing that. Yeah. And so, he like runs in and he like zip lines away from the building, like Batman and everything. But he's just some dude who fixes the air conditioning.
Fixes stuff. Yeah. I mean, and effectively he's like a pirate in this world. Right. He's off the grid. He's out of the system. In fact, he said he left the system because he was too frustrated with the bureaucracy. He just wanted to fix things.
This is the most libertarian moment of the movie, right? Where he's like, I just got tired of I just wanted to come in and work for someone and do the job and get paid. Right. I didn't want the government. Yeah. I didn't want the bureaucracy. And this is what makes him like a violent criminal.
Right, right. And they are hunting. They want to kill him. And sorry, just to be clear, the name that got mistaken was his name. Yes. His name was typed wrong. And this poor innocent fellow got killed. They were trying to take him out. This dangerous air conditioner repairman.
Yes, that's the beauty of the whole thing, right? Is like we discover that the reason the guy ended up getting murdered is not because, you know, he's this horrific terrorist or he's this menace to society. It's that they confused him with an illegitimate AC repairman. Like, that was the fatal crime. And so our character ends up meeting him, and that's important because he's a recurring character throughout the rest, but like you said, just in bit parts, he just shows up for a minute or two throughout the film. So I just want to make sure we mention that.
And no surprise, have to say, Robert De Niro absolutely nails it. They're some of the best scenes in the film. I mean, they're great. You
know? Yeah, again, absolutely. Just in there for the moment, but the moment he, and you forget, like it's really young De Niro, you know, it's in the 80s, you know, right. So it's a pretty young De Niro for that movie. But he goes, he takes this, promotion to the, Information Retrieval Bureau. And you're thinking, okay, well, so that means like he sits around and he does a lot of computer work, which they do, but he does this so he can find the girl, right? That's why he finally takes the promotion he always hated, so he can get the level of access necessary to search for this girl's name and everything. But what you slowly start to realize through clues, there's a stenographer listening to all of the tape from what's going on, and she's typing it out, and you slowly realize it's notes from a torture. Yeah, and then you run into his friend.
The retrieval of information, we're thinking like computer land, right? It's getting information out of the database. No. It's retrieving information from people by any means necessary.
Yes, exactly. And then he runs into his friend, which was introduced earlier in the film, a friend who was chiding him for being so low ranking and, why aren't you living up to your potential, the kind that your father and your mother expected of you. And you discover that, you think he's a doctor, and you slowly realize, oh, he's a doctor in the sense that, he's torturing people, and he's got this weird mask on. This kind of that's got the weird baby face. Again, if you've seen a couple images from the film, that's probably one that you've seen, the character in the torture chair with that. And so you slowly realize that's what's actually happening in this building. And it's even more horrific because the guy wasn't supposed to die. In fact, the way that the friend who's the torturer absolves himself of responsibility is that because there was a mistake made in the lower bureaucracy, the guy he tortured had a heart condition he wasn't supposed to have. And so he's not responsible for the murder.
He thought he was torturing Robert De Niro.
Exactly.
Some other guy. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, he got the poor hapless, kind of grandfather from the earlier scenes. And so that's the only reason that the guy died. And so he kind of puts off the responsibility. And again, how easily human life is discarded here. Nobody cares. No one would know. This woman is trying to track down things, and they don't even know that he's dead. And in the midst of this, for a lot of this, they don't realize the husband is dead for much of this. And no one would have told her probably if it wasn't for the discovery of this check and everything. And so there's just this constant showing of how no one can be held accountable. It's all people just dying to a ridiculous system. There's no responsibility anywhere inside of the bureaucracy.
Yeah, this Kafka-esque system doesn't have accountability. Everywhere you turn, you see people who find a way to do things, but not be responsible for what they're doing, not be held accountable for what they're doing. We're just a cog in the system. Don't look at me. It's nothing personal. It's just business, right? That's all the way through the movie. That's the attitude.
Absolutely. And again, you can't help but feel how relevant that is today. You know, how many police officers, how many FBI, how many even judges, people who are, they're given the task of being a linchpin in the system of adjudicating issues would just turn around and say, well, I got the wrong data from the experts. I got the blah, 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 blah. Yeah. You can't really blame me. I'm not really someone who can bear responsibility. It just mirrors how much of our system is what Carlyle would have called a government by steam instead of one where actual people are held accountable and make real decisions based on what they understand.
Right. Right. Yeah. So there's not decisions. There's just process.
Exactly.
It's all process all the way down.
And that's, again, that's what's so beautifully communicated in every aspect of the movie. Everything is hyper reality. There's no real experiences involved. Everything is an echo of an echo of an echo. You start to see, you know, there's technically Christmas happening and everyone exchanges gifts, but no one cares when they get them. Like no one ever opens them. No one cares about what's inside them. And everyone always gives the same gift. They've just got like 12 of them sitting around the exact same wrapping paper. You know, the billboards say, you know, like consumers for Christ are the old, you know, is the only kind of religious symbol we see involved with Christmas, you know.
Oh, I missed that. You're not kidding. Consumers for Christ.
Yeah.
Oof. Oof.
Exactly. But it reminds, you know, when we look at you know, our own government that just, you know, celebrated you know, Trans Awareness Day on Easter.
Trans Day of Visibility. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, and the way that every corporation and every government has reduced every one of our Christian holidays into the secular symbols. So you're not allowed to have anything about Christ on Easter or Christmas, but you can have Santa Claus, you can have reindeer, you can have Easter bunnies. You know, this is the worst thing. If anyone plays a video games that have like that live service type model, every one of these holidays is just like Egg Day or Bunny Day or Sleigh Day. Right. There's always this weird sanitized version of this. And again, it's just amazing how easily that's reflected out of this movie into our present day, where every one of these bureaucracies sanitizes these religious, you know, symbols.
One of the things that strikes me around, you know, we have family movie night every Friday night. And so we've watched a lot of the films that are suitable for children, right? Including holiday films. And one of the things that always strikes me is they will have the Santa and the Easter Bunny and so forth. But it's all about, it all ends up being about how you have to believe in Santa. The whole movie ends up, the linchpin is you've got to really believe in this fake thing.
Right.
or there won't be joy in the world or something. So it's like, wait, so are they talking about faith, but the faith is in a thing that we all know is imaginary? What's happening here? You know, but I see it in movie after movie after movie, the same thing, this huge emphasis on, you know, you got to clap for the fairy, right? And then Peter Pan or whatever, or she'll die. it's like that over and over through these holiday films.
Yeah, that is strange how it's like they feel that the archetype has to be presented inside the movie, but they know they can't present the real thing because that will offend people. And so you're right. We just get this weird iteration on the theme without any of the truth behind it.
A strong belief, a very strong belief in nothing in the middle, but nothing in it that you're actually believing in, right?
Yeah. So eventually he tracks this woman down. He gets the information he needs and discovers she's a trucker. So she's someone who is driving around and she goes to these industrial sites. Right. And he is assuming that she is a terrorist. Right. Like this is one of the things that he ends up thinking that she's a terrorist. She's delivering a package. And so she must be one of the kind of terrorists that people are talking about all the time. And so he accuses her of this, and you know, she says, "Oh, you work in an information retrieval. You're one of those guys." And he's like, "Well, I suppose you're one of the people that wants, you know, terrorists." And he's like, "She's like, have you ever met any terrorists? Do you know?" And again, it feels like we're trapped again. You know, what 30 years before the 9/11, you know, 20 or 30 years before the 9/11 events, you have this reflection of okay. The specter of terrorism means we have to submit to this constant bureaucracy, this constant security apparatus. Yes. Everything has to be monitored, surveilled. but no one has actually ever run into this situation. You know, like people die, like we see the terrorist events, you know, but no one is really sure who's responsible or how anyone would actually be held accountable again for this.
Why it's happening. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And that's what I was trying to get at earlier on, that the global war on terror era that I remember very well. It felt like Brazil was the movie for that era. You know, you've got to submit to all this apparatus they're building and take your shoes off at the airport, which we're still doing, etc. Because, you know, there's terrorists out there, man.
Well, and now they're doing it in the New York subway, right? Like they refuse to arrest people. They refuse to arrest criminals. In fact, the only people they arrest are the people trying to stop crime in the New York subway. And now they've brought in the National Guard and are doing, you know, airport style, you know, security for the subway. Yeah. Not because we don't know how to stop crime, but because they refuse to do it and they'd rather have the bureaucratic control. And again, that dispersal of responsibility, right, is the key. Right. We're not racist. We're not, you know, we're not judging people. We don't want anyone, we don't need cops to be. So we're just going to screen everybody all the time. Yeah. That's the
key. So we're now going to pat down grandma as a virtue signal or something. Yeah,
exactly. And I love that in one of the interviews, in kind of the very British moment, you know, someone is, they're playing the background interview with the TV and one of the British ministers, and they're asking him, hey, you know, why do you think there's terrorism? What do you think is going on? What's motivating these people to constantly commit these acts of terror? And the response from the minister is, I think it's a lack of sense of fair play. You know, they just a lot of people don't want to see someone else get ahead. And if they would just play by the rules, then they would be okay too. But they just can't stand it. You know, it very much is that very British sense of humor there. But a beautiful thing.
It makes me think of like they hate us for our freedom. You know, all that crap that they were peddling. You know.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's exactly the right comparison. What they hate us for is our freedom. There's nothing else wrong with this completely conformist, oppressive, depressing, you know, completely totalitarian society. It's our freedom. You know, that's our prosperity.
Yeah.
Well, and again, it's that theme of the information makes us free, right? It's the 1980. Is it 1984 that has, you know, the walls and bars make you free? I'm trying to remember if that's an actual quote from 1984. Well,
sure, but, you know, you have ignorance is strength and, you know, all that sort of those mottos.
But it really is that iteration of, you know, we of course we're free. Of course we're advanced. Of course we're civilized. We have the technology. We have the information. We have the bureaucracy. And that's what makes us, you know, the advanced civilization with the freedoms we have.
Yeah, I meant to say it earlier, but let me drop it in now, which is that, you know, as you talked about the world that he gives us, where, he's funny, right? It's a combination of this devotion to the idea of expertise and of bureaucratic process that is really well designed and all that, combined with a clearly incompetent system. Right. I mean, it's nuts how incompetent it is, but they really believe in it. Right. It makes me think of the progressives, not the progressives now, but the progressives from 100+ years ago or in the U.S. or the Fabian Society in U.K., where it's all about rule by experts. Right. And so, you know, we've got to get rid of the chaos of charity and have a welfare state instead that has experts, social workers, bureaucratic processes, right? That's going to be the solution. We've got to drop the term, right, Aaron? A managerialist system, right? That is going to solve our problems because we are going to rationalize it. We're going to line it all up, make it systematic, and then we're going to have wonderful outcomes, right? And that this movie could be read so many ways, but one of them as an absolute slam against rule by experts and the progressives.
Yes, and again, at every turn, like the oppression of the system, this very absurdist but dark aesthetic is contrasted with that high fantasy dream sequences. Right. Right, they're always peppered in to remind us that he's soaring above. Because one of the interesting things about the movie is it has, in a way, a some of the beautiful aesthetics that we would think of in some of these type of movies. It has a neo-noir, you know, art deco type look to it, right? Everyone's got the trench coats with the hat and the art deco statues. And so in some ways it would look like a Dark City or a Rocketeer in certain ways. But on top of that is this ugly layer of, I don't know, like 50s diners kitsch, right? Like, there's these weird windows and again the ducks everywhere. Everything, it looks like someone took a beautiful Art Deco city and then just like vomited a bunch of industrial, ugly, cheap stuff on top of it.
Right. Yeah. Speaking of the neo-noir part, one of the scenes visually that for me really stands out is people are leaving, I think, information retrieval, if I remember correctly. But there's a bunch of bureaucrats. They're all dressed with fedoras and trench coats. They look very much the same, right? They're all dressed very similarly. And they're all leaving work dressed the same. And if I remember correctly, the camera pans up and is above them. And just all these very similar looking figures pouring out of the building, these bureaucrats. Well, they're worse than bureaucrats, right? Pouring out of the building. It's one of those scenes that really stuck visually in my head.
Yeah, you have almost like ants just pouring out of the hill.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. 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 Very good. Yes.
Yeah. So he ends up thinking that she's a terrorist, and they go on this kind of long chase with the authorities. A lot of absurd things happen, but eventually he ends up being captured, right? And he ends up in the very torture chair that his friend operates. In fact, he finds out his friend is behind the mask, and he's trying to he's trying to appeal to him, his humanity, but he's trying to, you're embarrassing me. He's covering the microphone, making sure to pull his mask down so that his kind of emotion doesn't show. So even though he's known this guy for a long time, he's connected to his family. At the end of the day, it's just another business transaction. Another thing. But at the last second, the rogue HVAC guys rappel down, and they shoot the guy in the head, and they rescue him, the main character. They start taking him out of the building. I love that there's this huge, again, it's not as stylized as The Matrix, but it reminded me of that big lobby shooting scene, in The Matrix, where there's a huge firefight. But the whole time, the janitors keep cleaning, and the guy at the desk keeps doing boring paperwork. Like, and it's really great because the janitors, again, have like, they don't just have vacuums, like it's all got duct work being dragged behind it. So like all of the gun shootout are like diving over like vacuum cleaner duct that's being dragged across the lobby and everything. So it's this absurd, like high energy, firefight. There's gruesome, like there's bloody, there's gore in this for sure. It's rated R. But it's all happening in this very absurd, manner while everyone else is just carrying on the most mundane tasks. It's really fantastic.
Right. And so he's rescued. And ultimately he is back in the truck driven by his dream girl.
Right. Yeah.
And everything's wonderful. And this is the part that's a little confusing. And they leave the city together, right? They're getting out of the system. And this is the part that is a little confusing about the history of the film. I thought that it was released in America where it stopped right there with that wonderful happy ending. I'm a little unclear on that, but at least that was one of the cuts they had. But in the actual director's cut, Aaron, happens?
Yeah, that's the wild thing. You're right. So they go through, and it's interesting because even once he's rescued and he meets her, they kind of meet back. They're going back into these dream sequences again, so he finally gets her, he gets to bed her and everything, and they go through these dream sequences and you're not sure, like, okay, he's just seeing her the way he wants to see her. And then it cuts back to the way she actually looks and these things. And he like goes through this strange dream sequence of his mother, and he's like at a funeral, and this is where she's super young and she doesn't even want to talk to him anymore because she's surrounded by all. And so things are getting more and more dreamlike. They're getting further and further away from the real world, and he keeps tumbling through these different kind of vignettes of more surreal dream until eventually you get to the big kind of twist ending where you realize it's all a dream and he's still stuck in the torture chair. He never escapes. There was no There was no rescue. There, these, you know, Robert De Niro never shows back up and liberates him. And like you said, I think in the original, I only ever saw the movie many years after its theatrical release. So yeah. I'm only so familiar.
You saw the sad ending. Yeah.
Right. That was the only one I even knew existed. And then you mentioned this. And when we started diving into it, I was like, oh, I didn't even know this was a thing. And it looks like there was a battle between Gillum to keep in the edgier kind of depressing cut. But of course it didn't do well with audiences that were, you know, I want to watch Monty Python, you know? And so they kind of kept, like you said, they kind of, it looks like they kept, we haven't seen the other ending, so we can't comment on kind of the more toned down ending, but it does look like there was, you know, there's a Blade Runner-esque battle over the editing rights. Yeah. And that's the end.
Right. But the real ending, that the Gilliam director's ending or whatever, is that the torturers realize that he is just completely insane at this point. He's completely in his head, completely in his dreams. And the film ends with them just walking away with him in the chair, humming, of course, Brazil, right. The song Brazil, which is the theme throughout the movie.
Yeah, that's
I've always loved that song ever since that movie. I've loved the song.
when you explain the movie to people and you start with, it's called Brazil, and it has nothing to do with Brazil at all.
Yeah, right.
Does it take place in Brazil?
We probably should have mentioned that. It is not set in Brazil. It's right. Just the song represents a happier place or something, yes. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so go ahead. I wanted to talk about the dreams at some point.
Yeah, we'll definitely, yeah. I just wanted to say, for the ending real quick, what do you think about that ending? Because so many of these movies do end on a happier note when they're in this theme. There is some form of liberation. There's some crack in the system that allows you to know that you're going to make it through. Of course, 1984 doesn't do that. You know, Winston eventually, yeah. You know, becomes realizes his love for Big Brother.
Brave New World, the man who's outside of the system, who's come into the system, just hangs himself. Right.
Right.
So yes. Yeah. He's really keeping with the darker dystopian tradition here.
What do you think that says about, you know, his understanding of the bureaucratic system and what he thinks will be the possibility of people breaking through?
Well, this is the time to show your book, The Total State.
Yeah, right. Yeah. My commercial.
I was actually thinking about it, thinking back through this film, because it is the moments of escape from this total bureaucratic state in the film are all illusions, right? So in the film, as the viewer, you get to go with him on his dream, in his dreams, and you get to feel a relief from the ugliness and the bureaucracy and the system, the soulless system. But it's clear in the film that that is all just made up in his mind. That's not the lived reality of the people in this world, right? That is him wanting to be out of it, but not succeeding. And of course, at the end, he really doesn't succeed, even though he's, you know, gone crazy and sort of thinks he has, right? He's never able to get out of the system. So yeah, I mean, I think that the whole point that Gilliam's doing is that he's really going to do a dystopian. He's going to go for it, right?
Yeah.
He's not going to give you any signs of like, oh yeah, but there's this bright side to it. No. Any bright side that you think is there is a trick, an illusion. You're going to wake up someday or whatever, and you're going to realize that no, there is nothing else but this. It's pretty soul crushing, actually.
Yeah. I mean, I hadn't thought about that in its entirety, but you're right that there's every moment of hope, like every moment of resistance really is one in which it's an illusion. Maybe the only thing that's even a deviation is the Robert De Niro character. Like, we're pretty sure he's real. And even in that moment, his act of rebellion, like his very edgy way to escape the system, is to go out and repair stuff for free to people when the bureaucracy isn't getting around to it. That's as wild.
So he's not exactly an anarchist tearing it down or something, right?
even the greatest act of defiance in the movie is simply a maintenance of the system. It's simply a more efficient version of maintaining what the world that they live in.
Yeah.
There is no moment where there's actual liberation there.
Robert De Niro's air conditioner repairman is just containment, Aaron. Face it.
It's true. Very true. So you wanted to say more about the
So thinking about this movie and maybe some of the other themes in Gilliam's film, I wanted to particularly mention The Adventures of Baron Munchausen. It's a big favorite of mine. And I think that if you like Brazil and you haven't caught Baron Munchausen, I'd really recommend it. And I think you'll see a lot of similar themes. And as I was mentioning, Aron, I think it has the best, like, little, it's like 30 seconds, 30, 60 seconds reactionary moment in a Gilliam film that absolutely slams like the French Revolution and leftist violence. It's just marvelous. It's worth seeing for that. And there's so much more in there. It got me thinking the strong theme of dreams. It got me thinking about escape. And that got me thinking about Tolkien writing about fantasy in his wonderful essay on fairy stories, and in which he addresses the critics who say, the problem with fantasy is that it's just escapism. You're just trying to get away from the real world, right? And so Tolkien responds to this very thoughtfully, and he says, you know, usually in real life, when we talk about escape, it's a positive thing. You know, you're trapped and you escape from the trap. You're in jail, you escape from the jail, right? You're escaping into freedom, right? And he says, so why couldn't fantasy be, as I think we see it is in Brazil, why can't it be an escape from your awful system that you guys are a part of, you know? This modern dystopian, bureaucratic, soulless machine that we're more and more getting trapped in. Is that okay? Can we escape from it, even for a moment, even while we read a little story? Can we be out of your system, please? Anyway, so that's something that this movie made me think of, which I had never made that connection before, thinking about Tolkien on escape.
Yeah, it's interesting that there's never any moments of fantasy on the... We see a lot of media in the movie, but it's never anything of escape. It's always news. It's always a discussion. Yeah, and yeah. Part of that is obviously just moving the story along. It's just you know, just story pipe. But there's also the fact that in this omnipresent bureaucratic state where, you know, you would often see, you know, in other dystopias, some kind of propaganda film or some kind of entertainment that at least had the propaganda message inside of it. There's never any of that. There's never any escape. There's never even a moment of levity. Again, like you said, the only escape is ever through the dreams. The right. People inside are never allowed to view something. I don't think they do have, I guess they do have the movies. We do see real world movies. I want to say It's a Wonderful Life is on there at some point.
That sounds
like it's around, but we do see it's connected in some way to our own world. There's nothing new. There's nothing new that is media produced that's escapist by the system. The only thing they seem to have is left over from a time where they weren't trapped in, I guess, this level of bureaucracy.
So here's a beautiful line from this section I'm thinking of Tolkien. He says, why should a man be scorned if finding himself in prison, he tries to get out and go home? Or if, when he cannot do so, he thinks and talks about other topics than jailers and prison walls. I love it.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to go ahead and pivot over to the questions of the people. But before we do, Stephen, you have an excellent podcast. You do a great amount of work on the violence of the left, which I think is really important. It's something that doesn't get documented enough. Can you tell people a little bit about that and where to find it?
Yeah, I'll mention that. So I have a channel on YouTube called Radical Liberation. We do some economic analysis every other week. And then on the other weeks, I kind of do political history and things like that. One series we concluded recently is called the Left Wing Terror Series. And this tries to fill in the blanks for the, as we joke about on the internet, why some things happen for no reason at all, right? So in the Left Wing Terror Series, I try to fill in the for no reason at all. And show how there's a consistent history for hundreds of years, particularly with the French Revolution afterwards, but we actually start the series prior to that. There's a history of what I think is fair to call left-wing terror, where there's assassinations, there's terror bombings, like we see in Brazil, right? And this is all in the name of seizing power so that they can impose their utopia, right? And then it doesn't work out so well, and it's time for another round of left-wing violence to try to make the utopia happen this time. Many of these episodes I talk about are not well-remembered. For example, one of the episodes is about Red Bavaria, when part of Germany was taken over by communists after World War I. Another section is about Italy, where a number of Italian cities were taken over by communists. And this is all flushed down the toilet because it doesn't make the left look so good. And our history, as I think you figured out, Aaron, is seems to be pretty much curated by the left.
Written by the victors, unfortunately.
Yes. Yeah. Written by the victors. Yes. Well put.
Yeah. Everybody should definitely check those out. Like I said, they're historical deep dives of a lot of things that people are not familiar with. And like you said, when you start filling in, it's amazing how much, you know, go further down these rabbit holes. The more history you know, the more, you know, events make sense. And you're like, oh, wow. Things
that's
didn't
why they
just
did
suddenly
that.
Happen. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Can actually
causality.
See it.
Causality. It's a thing.
Yeah. Who knew? It wasn't just that everyone who disagreed was evil all the time. All right. So let's go ahead and go to our questions here. Creeper Weirdo says, but have you watched Brazil 200 times? Then you'll fully understand it. You know, again, the story of Brazil is not particularly complicated. There's not, you know, there's a couple twists and turns, but you can follow it pretty easily. The interesting thing, the thing is how much of the visual you can catch. We talked a lot about the visual representation.
There's a lot going on the screen. You brought out details. Now I'm wanting to watch it again because I'm like, well, I don't remember catching the janitors. Anyway, So there's a lot of things that, like, the main thing happening on the screen has got your attention. And off in the corner, there's something really funny going on if you just notice, right?
Exactly. Yeah, that's the feeling I have the whole time is you could do a Where's Waldo to find all the absurd little bits that are occurring in each scene. So it's one of those things that definitely benefits from a careful watching, not so much for the story, but for the visuals. We can talk about it ad nauseum, but it's something you really should see for yourself. We haven't, even if Absolutely. We just spoiled the ending for you, it's worth watching just because you capture all of those visuals. Capitalismo says Gilliam is great, but Baron Munchausen is the best of the Imagination Trilogy. Yeah, he must have said that before.
I've heard the term Imagination Trilogy. That might be Time Bandits Brazil and the Adventures of Baron Munchausen, because the later films are The Fisher King with Robin Williams, 12 Monkeys, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. And then some later, more recent films. But those are sort of the classic, the 80s and the 90s films, I think, are really, if you watch those, you'll understand why Gilliam's one of my top two directors of all time.
Yeah, obviously, I've seen the Monty Python stuff, Fear and Loathing, 12 Monkeys, Brazil, and then I saw the one of the newer ones he had, like the Imaginarium of somebody.
Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. Yeah, I have not seen that one. Yeah,
I think I'm trying to remember. It's like the main actor died in the beginning of the film, and so they end up replacing him throughout the film with different people because, you know, they like turned it into a visual kind of language, which is an interesting way to solve that problem. But but that's all I really remember about that movie. But
I love 12 Monkeys. It's
that's a
classic performance by Brad Pitt, I think, right?
It's Willis and Pitt, I think, right? It's Bruce Willis for sure. And Bruce Willis is the time traveler, and then Brad Pitt is the bad guy, I think, if I remember correctly. But that's one of those that kept popping on to like TNT all the time when I was like one of those channels that played movies all the time in the middle of the day. So I remember that one. Roberta says, honest question, do you guys think terrorists, the terrorists are real? I know Gilliam hinted that they are, but I'm wondering what you guys think.
I think you said it right, Aaron. He doesn't really ever give us, that is not the story we're being told. We're not being told the story of the terrorists.
Yeah.
The main character thinks that his dream woman is a terrorist, but that's not correct, right? So the terrorists are a backdrop. And I don't, frankly, I don't think he ever tells us or even suggests whether the terrorists are real or what's it called, a false flag or a mix. You kind of bring your own ideas to that, but I don't think he really gives us much. Did you catch something?
No, I had the same feeling. It really is that, yeah. You know, especially as the dreams get more thoroughly mixed in, and it's not always clear, you know, how much of a scene is reality, that becomes more and more of a question as well. And I think it's like Blade Runner, as where, you know, the more information you get about what actually is happening, the worse the film gets. Like the cuts where they try to explain everything about, you know, who's a replicant and who isn't and who's definitive. It's like, no, actually the ambiguity is a much better aspect of the film. So I think it's actually better that we don't know how much of that is manufactured by the government, how much of what happened is his imagination. I think all of that being ambiguous is part of the charm and Creepy Weird also says Jesus comes with baggage, Santa comes with Coke. I see what you did there. See what you
very
did
good
there. Well, we're gonna go ahead and wrap this one up, guys. Again, make sure to check out Steven's channel, especially that Violence of the Left series. That's an excellent
Left Wing Terror.
Left Wing Terror.
There's a playlist. If you go to my channel, you can find the playlist. It's all there in order.
Absolutely. And of course, if it's your first time on this channel, make sure that you go ahead and subscribe. Make sure that you turn on your notifications, click the bell, everything that you need to catch these streams when they go live. If you'd like to get these broadcasts as podcasts, make sure that you go ahead and subscribe to the Orin McIntyre Show on your favorite podcast platform. And if you guys would like to check me out over on Timcast, I'll be on the show tomorrow night. So I'll see you over there. Thank you for watching, guys. And as always, I'll talk to you next time.